including a national security advisor, 13 Russians, a couple of aides, the son-in-law of a Russian billionaire, and the president's former campaign manager. And 5 guilty pleas have already been entered, and the chances that some people are talking their heads off is about equal to that of finding seagulls in a dumpster behind a fish cannery. The president and his designated barky dog, Rudy Giuliani, both say it's time to wrap things up, but many of us won't be happy until someone in the Trump administration is photographed with a trench coat draped over their handcuffs as they're perp-walked into federal custody, and you're just the guy to do it. So happy birthday, Robert Mueller's investigation, and many more. Who wants cake? For KZFR Radio, I'm Will Durst.
Non-Human Radio is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters like you and by the local seasonal and organic delights at Farm Star Pizza, where the farmer is the star. Farm Star features artisan pizzas, salads, appetizers, and desserts with vegan, oh yes, vegan and gluten-free offerings, craft beer, and eclectic wines. Farm Star Pizza is open Monday through Friday for lunch, noon on Saturday and Sunday, and for dinner, 7 nights a week with live music on Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday. They're located at 2359 The Esplanade. Visit farmstarpizza.com or like them on Facebook. And we're made possible by Knockout Collision Repair, the Chico's high-end auto body shop specializing in complete collision repair and restoration. At Knockout Collision, estimates are always free and can usually be done while you wait. They even handle all the insurance paperwork. For an appointment or information, call Knockout Collision Repair at 899-9202 or visit them at knockoutcollisionrepair.com. This is KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, Non-Human Radio. Hello and welcome to the May 23rd, 2018 episode of Non-Human Radio, where we talk animal rights and veganism every Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. here on KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico and streaming online at kzfr.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Non-Human Radio. I'm Jeannie Trezino.
And I'm Danny Toms. Today we'll be talking about the rally to phase out drift gill nets in California, the Spanish Guggenheim exhibition of 2 controversial Chinese artworks featuring animals that was previously pulled from the New York Guggenheim, and a critique of the North American model of wildlife conservation, the so-called scientific method of wildlife management practiced by many wildlife agencies in North America. Jeannie, what's up?
All right. Thank you, Danny. I thought we would talk about the rally to phase out drift gill nets in California. That's coming up next Tuesday in Sacramento. That's May 29th. The rally is a project of the Turtle Island Restoration Network, which is organizing support for California Senate Bill 1017, which calls for a phase out of deadly drift gill nets in California's swordfish fishery. Did you know California is the last state that allows the use of this harmful type of fishing gear? It surprised me.
It's surprising, yeah.
This relatively small fishery, which has fewer than 20 active fishing boats, kills more dolphins, whales, and porpoises than all the other fisheries on the West Coast and Alaska combined. Where am I? So...
drift nets.
Oh, drift nets are walls of netting that float in the ocean. And these are extremely harmful, as high numbers of sea animals, including protected species such as dolphins, sea lions, and seabirds, are caught, killed, and thrown away by the drift net fishery. And this is what is known in the industry as bycatch, which if you've listened to our show before, we've talked about the issue of bycatch, which are non-target critters, whether they're other fish. If you're fishing for swordfish and you're getting sharks, you would have some statistics on sharks.
It's like if a deer hunter was allowed to shoot anything that moved across all the forest, kill everything, and then just take out the deer. Like,
yeah.
You wouldn't stand for that. So why do we allow it for fishing?
So this loss of life is a massive threat to marine ecosystems, as you can imagine. And drift nets themselves are already banned in many countries. And large-scale pelagic drift nets, which actually those are like miles long, were outlawed in 1993 on the high seas by the UN General Assembly. And the U.S. has implemented that as a matter of policy. But on the U.S. West Coast, the state of Washington banned drift nets in 2001, and Oregon abandoned its drift net fishery program in 2009. And so at this time, we are looking at the only drift net fishery for swordfish in the United States remains active, and that is in federal waters off the coast of California. The California drift net fishery, it has one of the highest bycatches in the United States, despite being under regulation for decades, as well as self-regulating. Swordfish is the primary target species of this fishery, and it makes up only 12% of the catch. 65% of the catch is discarded directly overboard as bycatch, and the remaining is retained for sale or for bait.
I mean, it's just horrific.
Yeah. Like, so I looked it up. So I haven't eaten fish in decades. I'm like, who eats this fish, right? Mm-hmm. And it's primarily sold at restaurants. It looked like it turns up in Southern California a lot on a lot of fancy restaurants. Listeners may be familiar with the Monterey Bay Aquarium recommended fish list for sustainability. This is what the our local restaurant, Aonami, goes by for the fish that it serves on its non-vegan menu. Well, it turns out swordfish, specifically California swordfish, fished from this fishery, are marked as a good alternative. They're a yellow fish. They're not green and they're not red like a do-not-eat fish, but they're actually a good alternative. So I point this out only to say these guidelines that help you to, like, feel better about what you eat, it may not, you know, really be all they're cracked up to be.
How, you know, in any industry that sells a product that kind of helps define its own standards, you know, how low are those standards?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
This sounds like each slice of local organic swordfish some rich person in L.A. eats, you know, kills 20 or 30 or 40 other creatures.
Yeah, and that's characteristic of the whole fishing industry. Yeah, but particularly this, it seems that the swordfish fishery is particularly egregious. So, yeah, 12 leatherback turtles. And you know what's interesting? I'm going to read off a bunch of statistics. And what's interesting is that we actually have these numbers. So this is an industry that is regulating. It's is forced to produce these reports and document its numbers. And as long as it does that, it keeps going. So hence the need, the call for this ban on this fishery.
And also these numbers will then be underreported that you're about to read.
Well, sure, there's that too. So 12 leatherback turtles and an estimate, 12 leatherback turtles are estimated to have been killed by California's drift nets in the 10-year period from 2004 to 2014. Loggerhead and leatherback turtle populations have been declining by 80 to 90% in the last two decades. So, of course, even a single death within that population can have a significant negative impact on the species extinction risk, right? Both as a breeder and as a decrease in the genetic variation available in the population. This fishery also entangles more cetaceans, which are whales, dolphins, and porpoises, than any other fishery along the U.S. Pacific coast. In a three-year period between 2007 and 2010, the swordfish fishery off of the coast of California caught an annual average of 68 marine mammals per year. Between 2004 and 2014, that's a decade, 21% of the catch consisted of IUCN red list species. These are species listed as either threatened or on the verge of extinction or highly threatened for extinction. And that includes the leatherback sea turtle. It includes sperm whales, shortfin mako sharks, bluefin tuna, and smooth hammerheads, right? So I think that the swordfish population itself is not threatened, but all this bycatch is what makes this fishery so dangerous.
And all that damage is done by 20 boats, as you said before, which is probably 100 to 200 people's livelihood in exchange for near extinction of species.
Like a lawnmower in the sea, right? Vulnerable blue sharks make up 5% of the catch and are typically discarded directly overboard, dead or alive. In the last decade, over 8,000 blue sharks were caught in an astounding... I'm sorry, let's give you the numbers. 8,186 blue sharks were caught, and the records show that 8,180 of them were discarded. So six they did something else with besides just dumping them overboard. And of those fish that were sharks, these blue sharks that were discarded, about 5,000 were already dead. So much suffering. In the last 10 years, an estimated 26,000 sharks overall were caught by this deadly fishery, with nearly 10,000 being simply tossed overboard, nearly half being tossed overboard. One interesting critter, the megamouth shark, was only recently even discovered to exist in 1976. And since then, fewer than 70 megamouth sharks have ever been reported. And nearly 10% of all megamouth sharks ever reported globally were entangled in California's drift nets. So they were reported as a result of this this process, this recording process that this fishery is forced to undertake. And yeah, 10% of the 70 specimens ever reported have been from this fishery. Interestingly, almost 50% of the catch is made up of ocean sunfish, who are this fish, its role in the marine ecosystem. They are the primary consumers of jellyfish. And although these sunfish are mostly released alive, there's very little information on the post-release mortality or population and impacts of the catch on the estimated 85,000 sunfish in the last decade. So proposed regulations on the fishery off the coast of California have been halted by the Trump administration in the summer of last year. So the proposed regulations would have temporarily shut down the driftnet fishery for a period of 2 years if too many whales, dolphins, or sea turtles were caught in the nets during a fishing season. And so this rally is for Senate Bill 2017, and it's to get it out of the Senate. So looking for support so that we get our state senators to vote in support of this bill and get it out of the Senate so that it can be voted on by the entire legislature. So and that rally is going to be held on Tuesday, May 29th. There's going to be a rally, and then if you sign up through Eventbrite or you can check the Facebook event through the Non-Human Radio page, the organizers have also set up lobbying meetings. So you get to meet the important Congress folks who will have an impact on whether this bill goes forward or not. So there you go. This was like, I had to share this because I had no idea we even, I know of drift nets as like an industry that exists elsewhere.
Right.
I don't think of it existing in California.
And they're frequently just illegally used out on the open sea anyway by kind of rogue.
Yeah, the high sea.
Rogue actors and rogue nations, but.
Yeah, that's a whole other issue of like how laws are enforced or not enforceable on the high seas because it's so, you're in between countries. So. Anyway, you've been listening to Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio. And I'm Jeannie Trezino, and we're going to pass it over to Danny Toms for our second story.
Spain's Guggenheim Museum has defended itself in the face of protest over the exhibition of two controversial Chinese artworks featuring animals. As we reported and discussed last October, these exhibits had previously been withdrawn from the New York Guggenheim after massive public protest. Yet they're being shown at a different Guggenheim. Let's get into it.
It's all in the family.
But the works will go on display when the 150-piece show comes to the Guggenheim in Bilbao, Spain, this month, a decision which has drawn the ire of animal rights campaigners. One work, Wang Yongping's The Theater of the World, features two cages containing toads, snakes, lizards, tortoises, beetles, cockroaches, and other insects. Zhu Bing's A Case Study of Transference shows a video of a boar and a sow covered in Eastern and Western symbols mounting each other in front of a crowd of human onlookers. So, I already ranted about this last October, but it's very dubious art. I can go capture any animal and put it in a cage and come up with a metaphor to slap on it.
To apply to it, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's no real creativity there. At this time, more than 823,000 people have signed a change.org petition, which was begun ahead of the New York show. So this is just the worldwide protest for the New York show that was demanding these works be pulled. Representatives of the Bilbao Guggenheim say the decision to display the works is about defending freedom of expression at a time when it is increasingly under threat. Okay, but the New York Guggenheim didn't. Okay. Begonia Martinez Goyenega, a spokesperson for the gallery, told London Telegraph newspaper that there was no cruelty involved in the installations, which she insisted met all legal standards on the treatment of animals. Whatever those are in Spain. She said the museum understood that some would be opposed to the display and respected their right to protest, but she insisted that the Guggenheim Bilbao had an obligation to protect artistic creation and freedom of expression. She added that the world was seeing a regression in the fundamental liberties, which were the basis of a healthy democracy.
I'd say we're also seeing a fundamental regression in the basic responsibilities we have towards our fellow earthlings.
Yeah, and Spain has never been known for their healthy democracy. Come on. Animal activists and local left-wing politicians have taken a different view, however. Udalberry, a leftist coalition in the Bilbao city government, said that living creatures should be left in their natural habitats. Amaya Arenal, a counselor from the leftist party and an art historian, said that her party... What are we saying here, Jeannie?
Oh, I'm sorry. That her party felt that the liberty of expression that the Guggenheim was defending is something that her party also stands for.
Ah, but it does not have the negative consequences for the third parties of the animals. You know, everybody's saying we stand for this, but can we stand for democracy without torturing animals? I don't see how that became part of that.
It's so difficult,
The rubric, right? Arenal went on to say, quote, "We don't think that an installation in a museum is an adequate place for these living beings to be able to live according to their needs, even more so when prey and predators share space inside the installation. Animals are not objects, and they deserve to be respected." PACMA, P-A-C-M-A, a Spanish animal rights party...
Which is just so refreshing to hear, right?
Yes. Also criticized what they said was the conversion of living beings into, quote, objects. Silvia Barquero, PACMA's president, told the Telegraph that the party respected freedom of creativity and expression, but she said animals should not be used as mere resources, converting beings with interests into mere objects, which go to form part of an artistic work. I don't know. Historically, there's been lots of weird... We're torturing animals, and we're pinning them to a wall and watching them wriggle, and somehow this is art. It's edgy. It's spectacle, you know?
Yeah, but it carries on, right? And so we see, you know, this exhibit that was protested in New York by Americans. It just moves overseas to Spain and proceeds on.
I think they're just like lots of institutions, you know, there must just be a resistance to any outside input telling them they can't do it, you know?
Yeah.
I somehow doubt they're fighting for their real principle here. They're just trying to avoid... anyone telling them what to do. It's not art.
So you've been listening to Animal News on Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio, co-hosted by Jeannie Trezino and Danny Toms. And now we're on to our last piece, which is a review from the animal advocacy website Faunalytics, which I highly recommend. It's Faunalytics, faunalytics.org. This site looks at journal articles relevant to animal rights and protection. In this case, they took a look at an article titled "Hallmarks of Science Missing from North American Wildlife Management," which was published in the journal Science Advances in March of 2018. So, most animal advocates oppose lethal methods of wildlife management as a first or predominant approach because these advocates, like myself, value the welfare of individual animals. Non-lethal methods of population control, such as fertility-blocking vaccines for deer, have proven to be effective in some urban and suburban areas, and so advocates believe that natural resource agencies, aka wildlife agencies, or fish and wildlife, or Department of Environmental Resources, or whatever they may be called, should explore these techniques as viable options when appropriate. Regardless of whether a management plan employs lethal or non-lethal management strategies or combination, it should be at least grounded in sound science that justifies their recommended actions, right? You would think that's like a baseline. This review is the first to assess the validity of agencies' science-based wildlife management claims. The authors of this study point out that natural resource agencies often claim to follow the North American model of wildlife, which states that, quote, science is the proper tool to discharge policy. However, these agencies rarely describe how their management is grounded in science. And you can see this policy, it's got a whole page to itself on the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's website. So it's adopted by other agencies. To conduct their study, the authors identified four hallmarks of science that should be present in so-called science-based management plans. One hallmark is that there are measurable objectives. These are all very common sense hallmarks. Two, there should be evidence. Three, there should be transparency. And four, there should be independent review. These are all characteristics of science. They determined these hallmarks by reviewing a broad range of literature on the application of science to wildlife management and identifying the top four components that occurred most frequently. They also established between one and five criteria that are associated with each hallmark, and they indicate the presence of that hallmark in the management plan that they're observing. These authors looked at 667 hunting management plans for 27 species across the United States and Canada to determine the extent to which these management plans contained these criteria and hallmarks. They found that over half of the hunting management plans they reviewed addressed less than half of the 11 criteria that they established for science-based management. So basically, the gist is these agencies are creating hunting plans to manage populations of deer or turkeys or other huntable critters, doves, ducks, geese, and they're claiming that they're science-based and that they know best. And yet when these researchers go and look at their hunting management plans across the continent, less than 50% are meeting these criteria. So some of their key findings, only about a quarter of the plans even included measurable objectives, which means that they may have not set a benchmark against which to determine the effectiveness of their management plan. Only about half of the plans provided information about a species population, and only 15% reported the degree to which their population estimates could vary. So that means that they don't have goals for their hunting plans. And very few of them even are accurate in their population measures, right? So if you're going to be using hunting as a population control tool and you don't have a handle on the population size, and if you don't even provide information on the population size in the first place, how effective is your hunting management plan going to be?
It works out pretty well when portions of your agency are, in fact, hunters themselves setting the rules by which they get to hunt.
We've always done it this way. This implies that agencies may not have determined reliable baseline populations to start with or to accurately predict changes in their populations based on their management plans. While many of the agencies publicly provided accessible information, such as being able to find their study on their website, you're able to find publicly accessible information on how they estimated the number of animals that are hunted or killed, only about 10% explained even how they set the quotas that do exist. And very few of the plans, about 6%, were subjected to independent external review. The authors noted that third-party review, such as peer review, is fundamental to scientific research because it ensures that independent review could help agencies gain the public's trust and interest. The findings of this review call into question the extent to which science even plays a role at all in wildlife management decision-making in the U.S. and Canada. While the authors acknowledge that management decisions should not be shaped by science alone, they do suggest that decision makers should disclose the role that science plays compared to other factors such as politics and economics. They also recommend that wildlife management plans be based on measurable evidence when this is the public's expectation or when agencies claim their plans are grounded in science. And I don't know, what do you think? Do you think the public has an expectation that you know, hunting season, the length and duration of it, or number quotas of huntable animals, that is based on science?
Well, sadly, I don't think most of the public thinks about hunting unless they're hunters. But I think anybody asking would expect to be able to get those answers, should you choose to ask.
Okay. Yeah, I don't have a good sense of that either. I mean, personally, I would hope that all these hunting plans are at least based in some kind of rational understanding.
You always hear, you know, they're going to starve. We got to shoot them or they're going to starve, you know.
Yeah.
And there's never, you don't hear any details behind it.
So because Faunalytics is an animal advocacy website, they end their review of this article. For animal advocates, the study supports claims that wildlife management decisions don't rely enough on scientific evidence. The indicator criteria also provides a mean for advocates, that's you and me, to assess whether wildlife management plans are sufficiently science-based, as well as the basis for campaigns that seek to protect certain ecosystems or species from exploitation through, quote, management plans. So that was a summary by the group Faunalytics of the recently published science article titled Hallmarks of Science Missing from North American Wildlife Management, published in the journal Science Advances in March of this year.
I think another important point, the lack of precision in what they're doing there. I mean, sometimes this isn't just about getting other animals to kill for people for fun or selling more hunting licenses. Sometimes this is about actually there are diseases, very bad diseases among certain populations, or there are certain environmental degradation happening and you're trying to control it. And if they're not even doing that scientifically, what exactly are they doing, you know?
I think that we can look back to the first story we talked about the swordfish fishery, which from the detailed numbers that we're able to provide, clearly there's numbers being captured.
Right.
But are they being applied in any kind of, you know, way to protect other populations or the ecosystem? That doesn't seem to be so obvious or even a goal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really. Alrighty. So now it is time for the Chico Animal Rights Calendar of Events. Get ready to mark your calendars. Jeannie, what is on the agenda?
Thank you, Danny. So here are some great vegan-friendly events to put on your calendar. And if you need more info, please send me an email at chicovegan@gmail.com. And that's for information or if you want to give me a heads up on some event that's coming up. This Saturday, May 26th, is the Chico Vegan Potluck hosted by Chico Vegan Meetup. And that'll be Saturday, May 26th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Chico Public Library at 1108 Sherman Avenue. The theme this month is vegan Mexican. So beans and rice, guacamole and chips, enchiladas, burritos, it all goes. If you're a healthier-minded person, the plant-based Chico group, hosted by Nancy Norby Matthews, will be having a special table for their whole foods, plant-based, no salt, no oil, no sugar added variation on vegan cuisine. And you can find the potluck details and the schedule for the whole year at chicovegan.com. I hope to see you there at 6 o'clock. Also, May 31st, next Thursday, Plant-Based Chico is having their monthly meeting hosted by Plant-Based Chico, and that will be on Thursday, May 31st from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Chico Guild Hall at 2775 Nord Avenue. Plant-Based Chico will be meeting on Thursday to share tips and tricks on how to be a happy, healthy, whole foods, plant-based vegan with no added salt, oil, or sugar. And this event is free and open to the public. And for more information, check out the Plant-Based Chico Facebook group. Also on May 31st, the Adventist Health Feather River Hospital is hosting their monthly Dinner with the Doctor. This is grocery shopping with a doctor. And that is on Thursday, May 31st from 6 to 9 p.m. At Beyond Fitness on the Skyway, 7224 Skyway. Food labels are useful in theory, but often confusing and unhelpful in practice. How can you know what's good for your body? What should you be avoiding for the sake of good health? Join plant-based Dr. Christine Sloop, MD, to learn how to read and understand the labeling on your food. Reservations are required, so please call 530-876-7154 to reserve your place. The lecture, the free lecture begins at 6:30 p.m., and the dinner part of Dinner with the Doctor starts at 6 o'clock, and that requires a modest fee. On June 2nd, we have the Local Herb Fair, hosted by the Elderberry Apothecary. on Saturday, June 2nd from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And that will be at Bidwell Park, Oak Grove A, between One Mile Pool and Caper Acres. This event is free and open to all. And for information, you can go to their website, which is www.theelderberryapothecary.org. You'll be able to learn what our land has to offer at workshops led by leading herbalists in our own Chico community. You can stock up on fresh herbal medicines, teas, and medicinal plant starts grown by local herbalists. Check out the awesome community organizations that the group has partnered with as well. Okay, that is it for the calendar. We have one last piece of business to take care of, and that's the animal rights quote of the week. Take it away, Danny.
Our animal rights quote of the week is from The Millennial Vegan, written by clinical psychologist and vegan animal activist Casey Taft. If you're already vegan, this quote is for you. Carry on being awesome and come find your people at the potluck on Saturday. Quote, I know many vegans who are afraid of being thought of as an angry vegan, so they don't talk about their veganism. This stereotype is promoted by non-vegans who would like vegans to remain silent about the abuse of animals. We as vegans should not let ourselves be silenced. You are vegan and should be proud of that. You should never feel like you need to silence yourself to keep others happy.
That's if you're vegan or if you have strong convictions on anything.
Non-Human Radio is made possible through the generous contributions of KZFR listeners like you. Thanks to Bill Mash and Sue Hildebrand for their engineering assistance and moral support. Stay tuned for The Real Issue coming up next at 6 p.m.
Our theme music is Ready to Fall by vegan activist rockers Rise Against.
This is Danny Toms and Jeannie Trezino signing off. Until next week, be different, be better, be kind.
And go vegan.